It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios, welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me, or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You all right?
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4-1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
She has physical signs that she is about to give a birth. Would that still be a point at which she could request an abortion if she was so certified? She's dilating.
Mr. Chairman, that would be a decision that the doctor, the physician, and the woman
I understand
would make
that.
At that
I'm asking
point.
If your bill allows that.
My bill would allow that, yes.
When we talk about third trimester abortions, these are done with the consent of obviously the mother, with the consent of the physicians, more than one physician, by the way. And it's done in cases where there may be severe deformities, there may be a fetus that's non-viable. So in this particular example, if a mother is in labor, I can tell you exactly what would happen. The infant would be delivered. The infant would be kept comfortable. The infant would be resuscitated if that's what the mother and the family desired. And then a discussion would ensue. We want the decision to be made by the mothers and their providers.
Well, that was two clips that you've probably heard by now. Sandy Rios with you. The first was Delegate Kathy Tran. We played that clip yesterday of her in the House of Delegates in Richmond, Virginia, presenting her bill, which would make abortion legal up to the date of birth, and including, you know, mother's ready to go into the labor. Can we kill the baby? Yes, my bill would provide for that. And then Governor Ralph Northam of Virginia, you know, Virginia has been in the past a very red state. And by that, I mean a state that holds to constitutional values, that fights for them. Virginians, you know, the passion of Virginians is in our bloodstream. They have done so many wonderful things. They were the writers of our Constitution. I mean, Virginians were. They gave us the University of Virginia. They gave us many of our founding fathers. Virginia has been a very strong state, and it's very upsetting, I can tell you, to people from Virginia who love their state and are proud of its heritage, to see what's happening with their leadership. Terry McAuliffe, of course, started this downward trudge to the bottom, and then Ralph Northam seems to be accelerating it. And Ralph, you know, is a pediatric neurologist, I think. And so as he was doing that radio interview and he was saying, well, you know, the baby would be born and made comfortable while the parents decide whether to kill it or not. That's basically what he's saying. That's what he's saying. And Kathy Tran, the delegate, is just, you know, explaining in very dispassionate terms that, yes, my bill would provide for that. Killing the baby when the mother's ready to be delivered. Yes, it would provide for that. It provides for so much more. In fact, Delegate Bob Marshall, who was the author of the Virginia's Partial Birth Infanticide Abortion Ban, says this: a trans bill would also strike down Virginia law, which had shut down filthy and unsafe abortion clinics and would remove the requirement that late-term second trimester abortions be performed in a hospital. And of course, this comes on the heels of New York State making the decision that abortion should be legal for all 9 months, and that babies can be killed after they're born if they're not wanted. It's stunning. It's astonishing. So you might wonder how pro-life groups are responding. And let me just tell you, they're coming out in force. And for that, I'm very grateful. Let me give you an example. Susan B. Anthony List is slamming this latest attempt to legalize abortion on demand through birth in Virginia. They are launching a campaign to defeat abortion radicals and protect the pro-life majority in the Virginia legislature. Susan B. Anthony List is in the business of electing pro-life women. It used to be pro-life candidates. I used to be their spokesman when they first started many years ago. I think they've drifted a little bit, but they still are a strong force for pro-life candidates, and for that I'm very grateful. And I'm hearing, although I don't have the details on this, there's going to be a town hall. For those of you in Virginia, Delegate Tran is holding a town hall this Saturday. It's going to be in South County High School in Lorton, Virginia. That's Fairfax County. South County High School, Lorton, Virginia. And there will be an event, a demonstration, something of some kind that you can be involved in. And let me just say it's going to be probably around noon or 1 o'clock. And so you'll have to watch for information about that. I probably can't follow up on that detail since it's a regional event. But I'm just saying, those of you in Virginia, look for that. It's going to be, again, outside her town hall at South County High School in Lorton, Virginia, midday on Saturday, just to let her know what you think about this thing that she's trying to do. And this is in Virginia. Of course, a lot of you are not in Virginia. By the way, that bill that she has proposed, they're saying it will not move forward, but some are saying it's still, you know, it's like in committee, it's not dead. It's just that it's not moving forward. So I would say as long as it's not just killed like Dracula with a stake in its heart, you have something to be concerned about. And Live Action is weighing in on this whole nonsense of what's happening nationwide, the unleashing of the abortion forces, feeling like, man, after this 2016 midterm election, 2018 midterm election, that they have won so much they're confident. And they think they can actually shove it down the throats of Americans to abort all 9 months, a baby, all 9 months, and even kill it after it's born. It is just amazing. So Live Action is encouraging President Trump and other pro-life leaders to now fulfill his campaign promise to defund Planned Parenthood, just defund it. And so thank God for that. I'm sure we'll follow up on that in more detail. Another event, if you are in Virginia, February the 7th, there's going to be a Commonwealth for Life, a march on Richmond. So that's something I think you'll want to be a part of. Commonwealth for Life, March on Richmond. That's going to be February the 7th. It's going to be from 10 in the morning until 1 o'clock, 10 in the morning. And it's going to be at the Virginia State Capitol. So pack your bags now and your coats and just put it on your calendar even as we speak. Make yourself a note, send yourself an email. February the 7th, and I would say for those of you out of state, if you want to come and join them and make a statement, because New York might be a little bit too far to go, but you could go to Virginia. So Commonwealth for Life, March on Richmond, that's February the 7th from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. So at the Richmond State Capitol. So this, if there's ever a time to be up in arms, it's now. You know, I'm actually still mad. I really am. I'm still mad at congressional leaders, Republicans primarily, who, when David Del Leiden's Planned Parenthood videos came out showing them allegedly selling baby body parts, strategizing how they were going to get wealthy, just talking about brains and heads and eyes as though they were just like selling candy bars, it appalled all of us. It was so upsetting, and we wanted at that point, I remember meeting in Senator Cruz's office many times with pro-life leaders and other conservative leaders to strategize on how to get, this was a time when the discussion was of a government shutdown. But of course, you know how Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan felt about government shutdowns. And so I saw most of the pro-life groups just cave. Most of the pro-family groups, they just caved. They didn't know, you know, we wouldn't want a government shutdown. Overselling baby body parts. If ever there was a reason for a government shutdown in which they would cooperate, unlike what they've done with President Trump over the wall, in which they would hold hearings, in which they would shout from the housetops what's happening. But they weren't willing to do that. And so so on it goes. So the pro-life, pro-choice forces have been emboldened, and why shouldn't they be? And so this is what's happening on that issue. I'm going to tell you that there's a movie on Kermit Gosnell's brutal abortion clinic in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. I'm sure you've heard the story. If you haven't, it is an incredible story. And there was a movie made about Kermit Gosnell. He kept babies in pickle jars in his office. Women died at his hands, which was what happens in abortion clinics. It's, you just don't hear it. And so this traces the story of Kermit Gosnell. It's a movie. Many of you have already seen it in the theaters, but it's going to be available soon on DVD. And it's probably not something you want your kids to watch because it's pretty, depends on their age. So you'll have to use your judgment about that. But it's going to be available on Amazon Tuesday, February the 4th. It's coming up. And so the idea, of course, is to, man, let's get this thing out. If anything will change the heart and minds of people on the issue of abortion, it would be this movie because it's so, it's just, the facts are so horrific. And yet it's not unusual. It's just unusual for us to hear about it. So February the 4th, you can order it on DVD from Amazon, Best Buy, or Walmart. It's not available in our store. It'll be Best Buy, Amazon, or Walmart. So you'll want to purchase that movie and share it with other people. All right, speaking of, I've got to get all this in. I had so many email and correspondence from you this morning. This is the first time I could not even finish. I couldn't read all of them. I'm going to take them and read them later, but I'm just saying wonderful comments from so many of you. Yvonne said she was at the March for Life for their first time, and she talked about how many kinds of people were there. Muslim women with a sign saying the Quran is against abortion, people from India protesting American money, murdering Indian babies. She said she's part of the Hebrew Roots movement. We were marching behind a ban from a Catholic school, and there was a secularist banner. There was a feminist placards, and she said it was just amazing, the unity over that issue. All right, I'm gonna move to something else because this is really important to me. Christian education, Christian schools, Christianity, for heaven's sake, is under attack like no other. And so there was a report on Fox last night about this, and I want you to hear it. Clip 7.
It began with a hashtag on Twitter just 2 weeks ago, Expose Christian Schools, and it surfaced after a private Christian school in Virginia announced Second Lady Karen Pence would teach art. Christian school advocates say the Expose hashtag has exposed a negative perception of religious schooling.
We're living in a time of a changing culture where there are many people who really find Christianity itself to be strange and sometimes even offensive.
Russell Moore is the president of the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission, and he says Christian education is no question under attack.
There are many, many people who have had positive experiences in Christian schools.
Leaders at Emmanuel Christian School, where Karen Pence teaches, are accused of banning LGBTQ students, employees, and gay parents of students. But supporters say what the school does is require strict adherence to scriptural beliefs. The move prompted outcry from the Human Rights Campaign and GLAAD. GLAAD reached out to Fox News in a statement. Quote, it's disturbing. Second Lady Karen Pence would put her stamp of approval on an institution that actively targets LGBTQ students.
To see major news organizations attacking Christian education is deeply offensive to us.
At a religious education forum in Washington today, Education Secretary Betsy DeVos came to encourage
school
leaders.
I'm going to interrupt this report because we're running up against the clock. I want to make this point. We are under attack. Christians are under attack. The heart of Christianity and its teaching, God himself, Jesus himself, is under attack. And so I have to say, we're going to have to fight and make the point. And if I were Russell Moore or Mike Pence, I would have said that have, for heaven's sake, Harvard, Yale, all the great educational institutions of this country were Christian schools initially, based on Christian teaching. The lack of passion in their response really disturbed me. In fact, let's play Russell Moore's clip very quickly. We're under attack, and this is what Russell Moore says. Clip
there are many, many people who have had positive experiences in Christian schools.
Really? If you're defending Christian schools, is that what you say? There are many, many people who've had positive experiences? Are you kidding me? Christian education is at the core of character, of order in society. It's at the tepid response, and by Mike Pence too, was as appalling to me as the report itself. We have to fight. We have to fight, and we have to fight for good reason, not for our own self-preservation, but for the truth. I'll be back after this. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
A call to action from American Family Radio.
There's all kind of difficulty in the world, but as the Word of God says, if if your brother's in need and you have it within your ability to respond to their need, how can you claim to have love if you allow them to go without? What greater need is there than the need to live? I know life is rough, but it don't have nothing to do with the baby. Don't kill the baby. Don't wait for preborn campaigns. Don't wait for legislation to be passed in your state legislature. Don't wait till Roe versus Wade is overturned. Respond now. I believe with everything in me that we can end this scourge regardless of what they do in the halls of Congress and the halls of the state legislature. Every single family, every single church, go to the local abortion clinics. Let them know that you have people in your churches, people in your family that are willing to take the babies home. They have families that have been dying to take a child home. Don't kill the babies.
Visit AFR.net.
Every day in the red light districts of Mumbai, India, there are young children living under the daily threat of being trafficked, abused, and exploited. Girls and boys as young as 8 years old. And this cannot go on any longer. Team up with American Family Radio and India Partners, because with your gift, you will provide shelter at an India Partner safe house far away from the city, and just $7.08 provides a day of shelter, meals, and care. Coming up here on American Family Radio, we're going to address the issue of child trafficking. Now, we aren't going to do it in a way that is graphic or unsafe for your children to hear, but we will tell you that we are going to be addressing a topic that could be a little uncomfortable. We hope you'll listen and team up with American Family Radio and India Partners to provide hope that could change, even save, a young child's life. So join us in this fight to provide days of safety. You can get more information by clicking the India Partners banner at AFR.net.
Hello, Americans. I'm Todd Starnes with news and commentary next.
Truett McConnell University.
My name is Dr. Robert Bowen. I am the Dean of Science, Technology, Engineering, and Mathematics, and I'm an Associate Professor of Physiology. So one of the benefits of being a faculty member at TMU is not only are we allowed to speak the gospel in the classroom and within our areas of discipline, we're encouraged to do so. Everybody needs to know the love of Christ. And so I try to incorporate in my classes, and one of the places that I incorporate in the most is in my office when I have students come in.
Are you called? Visit truett.edu today.
Lady Gaga, who once wore a dress made entirely of meat to an award ceremony, said she is a better Christian than Vice President Mike Pence. Miss Gaga told a crowd at her show in Las Vegas, "The Vice President is the worst representative of Christianity in the world."
And to Mike Pence, who thinks it's acceptable that his wife work at a school that bans LGBTQ, you are wrong. You say we should not discriminate against Christianity. You are the worst representation of what it means to be a Christian.
So the second lady, Karen Pence, is teaching art at a Christian school. The school requires staffers to follow the Bible's teachings on marriage and sexuality. Miss Gaga made a name for herself preaching about tolerance and acceptance, except apparently when it comes to Christians. It's just too bad Lady Gaga doesn't practice what she preaches. I'm Todd Starnes.
Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
Downtown Caracas turned into a protest zone for 2 hours Wednesday, scheduled by the opposition, before another major march on Saturday. It marks the first show of outrage by supporters of Juan Guaido since he declared himself interim president 1 week ago. The whistles and horns sounded the frustration of a populace battling 1,000,000% inflation, shortages of food and medicine, and a former bus driver, Nicolas Maduro, as president, reelected last year in a vote marred by wide-scale charges of fraud.
It can't be. Those men must be imprisoned. Imprisoned because they are harming children who are 12 and 13 years old. I have been protesting since 2002, and I won't stop protesting.
In what the White House said was a show of support for Venezuelan democracy, President Trump phoned Guaido, the opposition leader, now recognized by the U.S. as president of the country. Guaido told Fox News that Trump's support is critical.
I am certain that the concept of democracy by President Trump is very clear, and we lost it. We lost democracy.
Maduro told Russian media he would be open for talks to keep the peace, a strategy he has used in the past to divide the opposition and buy time. Maduro is also visibly shoring up his support from the military, sometimes even training with them in photo ops shown on state television.
We are on the right side of history. No one should doubt that. We have the historic reason, and we defend the truth of a history with more than 500 years of fighting.
But the financial backing that helps to support some loyalty could be eroding. Venezuela sells 500,000 barrels of oil a day to the U.S., 40% of its total sales, and one of its only sources of government income. That income will be cut sharply by U.S. sanctions on Venezuelan oil.
That was Steve Harrigan on Fox News last night. This is Sandy Rios back with you. I tell you, the thing that strikes me when I'm hearing these stories about Venezuela now is the resilience of the Venezuelan people. Honestly, we have been tracking, it's been a while now, it's been a few months, and we've been tracking what's going on in Venezuela, people starving to death, people not able to get basic elements, getting weaker, thinner, being brutalized, a terrible outbreak of criminal activity, the military out of control, the Supreme Court taken over completely, no justice anywhere, just persecution. And after the last election with Hugo Chavez, where he stole the election and anyone challenging him was prevented from running, all of those demonstrations in the street and people, I thought sometimes, like in Cuba, people reach their saturation point where they fight and they fight and they fight. I think of Iran also. I think of China, where there's an uprising, but it is tapped down. People are killed, punished. And then everything goes quiet and the dictators prevail for generations to come. And so I think the remarkable thing here is that in Venezuela, the people are still out in the streets fighting. That's pretty remarkable. My guest is Dr. Paul Coyer. Paul's been with us before. You may remember he's a research professor at the Institute of World Politics. His expertise is all things international. He actually lectures at the French equivalent of West Point. He teaches U.S. foreign and national security policy, the role of religion and cultural and international affairs. He's a contributor to Forbes, and there are a lot more things to say about Paul, but also he's married to a beautiful Venezuelan woman, and he joins us this morning. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning, Sandy.
You heard my opening there, Paul, and would you agree with my analysis there? Do you find it kind of striking that the Venezuelan people are still fighting back?
Yes, that is indeed striking. they really lost hope in the Venezuelan opposition, which is one of the biggest differences now. They have two major differences that have taken place over the last few months that have given them the courage to come back out on the streets again. Number one is we have this young, fresh face. He's only 35 years old, Juan Guaido, of the party Popular Will, of Voluntad Popular. And he's actually taking action. And one of the things the people in the streets have said, the Venezuelan people have said, is our opposition is hapless. They're divided. They have no plan. They don't ever take any bold action. They talk a lot. They're not here on the streets with us. We're the ones risking our lives. And they didn't have a lot of faith in them. And frankly, some of the opposition is as corrupt as the government is itself, sadly. So we have this fresh face that's young. He has gone out on the streets himself. Every day he's appearing in the streets with the crowds, which shows a lot of physical courage as well as political courage. And it's helped bring people out. And the second major dynamic is President Trump has, since the beginning of his administration, been very vocal in the defense of the Venezuelan people and has taken concrete actions as well. But now the administration has been working behind the scenes with the opposition, and they told the opposition that if you elect somebody as your president of the National Assembly, like Juan Guaido, we will support you, and that can be the tipping point. We will lead world opinion, and we can then legally, if we support him as a legitimate president, we will legally, under international law, have the right to stop payments from Citgo gas revenues, which is, I believe, about $7 billion a year, approximately. I may have that figure a little wrong, but it's pretty close to that. That has been going to Maduro. And the Trump administration said we want to stop sending that money toward Maduro, really put the squeeze on him. And this is really something that we didn't want to do. We didn't want to sanction PDVSA, the petroleum oil company, and take these extreme acts. But now we feel like we just have no choice. And the people of Venezuela, they support it completely. They're already starving. They're already brutalized. They just want to do whatever it takes to get rid of Maduro.
You know, Paul, I think it would be a good thing to go back in time a little bit because, as you know, most Americans are not taught any kind of history, not even our own now, much less other
right.
peoples and other hemispheres. But
right.
Let me just say, my understanding, as far back as the 60s and 70s, maybe earlier, there were so many coups in South and Central America. It was communist infiltrate from Russia and China infiltrations, mm-hmm. and there were so many takeovers by force and military force, and that was much of the conflict. And then my understanding is that Fidel Castro, the longtime president of Cuba, dictator of Cuba, started moving, working through a different method called that came out of the Sao Paulo Forum, which was to encourage would-be totalitarians to take over through the democratic process rather than have a violent coup, and then once elected, start taking power. And that's what I think happened, and I'm sure you would agree with Hugo Chavez. In fact, say just a word about that, about what he did. Now, because before this, Venezuela was the richest country in South America, right?
It was, and for about a decade after the Second World War, for a while, and it was the fourth richest country in the whole world, as measured by GDP per capita, which is an amazing thing. It was just underneath the United States, Switzerland, and I've forgotten the number three now, and then Venezuela's number four. So we're talking, it was doing very well. But to answer your question about Hugo Chavez, I want to just briefly go back to 1958, because as we know, Fidel Castro came to power in January 1959. Now go back one more year, January 1958, January 23rd to be exact, which is why Guaido took the oath of office as interim president on that date, January 23rd, because that date is very important in Venezuelan history. They had a dictator, a military dictator, and there was a coup against him. And coups are usually seen as always as universally bad things as being authoritarian. This was the opposite, and the opposite can happen sometimes in history. There can be a democratic coup against an authoritarian leader, and that's what took place. So the army took over together with the democratic opposition. They rewrote the constitution. They instituted democracy. Institutions started to strengthen. Democracy took root. Transparency grew. All the positive developmental indicators and political indicators were going in the right direction for the next 40 years. So now this is interesting because that took place pretty much exactly parallel with Fidel taking over Cuba and Cuba going in the opposite direction. So fast forward to the early 90s, the Soviet Union has imploded, and Fidel Castro realizes that he's lost his sugar daddy, basically. He doesn't have the vast subsidies the Soviets gave Cuba any longer, and the Marxist political system, as we know, is not really a political system. They needed help. They needed another country that they could be a parasite on. And he looked right in his neighborhood and saw Venezuela. Now, Venezuela in the 60s, 70s, and into the 80s was just burgeoning economic growth. People, instead of migrating out to the country, as they have been in the last few years, were migrating into Venezuela from all over. My own wife's adopted family were refugees from Fidel and Cuba. They were typical of the kind of people that came to Venezuela because it was such a prosperous society. So, early 90s, Fidel loses his patron, the Soviet Union. He needs a new country that he can get free things from, that he can get, that he can suck value out of, oil and whatever else. And he casts upon this young military officer named Hugo Chavez, and he realizes that Hugo is smart enough to be a good leader, and he's devious enough to know how to really handle power, but he's also dumb enough where Fidel can manipulate him. And Fidel was a very wily old fox, and he basically, according to somebody who was with the CIA for about 30 years, who was their top Cuba analyst, who was now teaching the University of Miami, Fidel recruited personally Hugo Chavez as a Cuban agent and ran him. And the coup took place, the attempted coup in 1992, famously now when Hugo lost, but he was, in exchange for dropping the violent challenge of the government, Hugo was given, I think, 10 minutes or something like that on national Venezuelan television to state his case. And he basically said, my battle is not over. It's only over for now, he said in Spanish, which means I'm coming back. And that's indeed what he did. He was put in prison, but he won a lot of popular support. So the president of the day let him out. He ran for president in 1998, and suddenly Fidel has his own little puppy dog, his own agent, as president of Venezuela. So Cuba has been a pernicious influence for a long, long time, and they are a big part of the problem. And the Trump administration is well aware of that.
So did Chavez, well, he was the one then that started bringing in Cubans to be part of the armed forces, the security services,
security
the
forces,
intelligence services.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And there's about 40,000 of them right now in Venezuela. It's a lot.
Wow. So then when Chavez gets sick, he handpicks Maduro, the bus driver, really, I guess you could say, continued the decline in the sense of the decline for the poor people, you know, in terms of inflation and just draining the resources. It's just so sickening to watch it from a distance. You know, Paul, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you that at the same time. This is a question I can't I really don't know the answer to, but I do know that there's been a very strong evangelical church, meaning, I don't mean a building, I mean in, you know, the people of God by that name, in Venezuela. I don't know the genesis of that. I mean, do you?
When it actually began, I don't either, I have to be honest. I don't know exactly when it began, but I know evangelicalism and the growth of Protestantism, especially evangelical-leaning parts of Protestant churches, have been exploding in Latin America for at least the last 20 to 30 years, maybe longer. And they are completely transforming the politics domestically, regionally, in Latin America, and how that continent is relating to the rest of the world. We see that prominently in one of Venezuela's neighbors, Brazil. The evangelical vote was one of the things that put the new Brazilian president, Bolsonaro, over the top. It's having the same effect in other countries. So right now, there's a religious freedom aspect of what's happening in Venezuela because both the Catholic Church and the evangelical and Protestant community there have been very vocal and very strong in standing up against the socialist dictatorship of Nicolas Maduro. And they have been taking a hit for it. So they're a very positive influence there. Again, that's also a topic potentially for another interview, another conversation, is the growth of evangelicalism in Latin America, because it's going to continue to grow. And in some countries, it's now about 50% Protestant, 50% Catholic, which was never the case before in Latin America.
Isn't that something? Well, see, we know this is how God works. We saw the church in China just explode when we didn't even know it. They were shut off, and we didn't have any kind of official relationship with China. Nobody knew about it. When we went in, when President Nixon went into China, lo and behold, we find millions of Christians in an underground church. Let's come back to the subject of Venezuela. You and I've talked before, Paul, in great detail about the suffering of the people. I've at least touched on it a few minutes ago about the starvation, about the criminality in the streets, just the dreadful stories. So enter this Juan Guaido. And you've already told us something about him. He's 35 years old, but what else can you tell us about him? I mean, who is he, for heaven's sake?
Yeah, well, he's an engineer by training. I hosted a close friend of his and political ally, David Smolensky, at the Institute of World Politics this past Monday. David and Juan Guaido and several others began their political party, Voluntad Popular, that I mentioned earlier, back in 2009. It is a centrist social democrat party. Now, the social part of social democrat means socialist. Now, I realize that our listeners, and that would include, you know, I would agree with this sentiment. That's not something that we would think was the best route forward for Venezuela. However, it has to be emphasized that the people that I've met from this party are very good people, are actually democratic in their outlook, are pro-free market in their outlook. They just believe there's a bigger role for the state than I think there should be.
Okay,
but
Paul, let me interrupt you because the music's playing and I want you to have a chance to really flesh that out a little bit because we want to talk about this whole business of socialism, its implications for us, and we have to have a better understanding. So Dr. Paul Coyer is my guest. Again, he's with the he's a professor at the Institute for World Politics, among a million other things that he does. We'll be back right after this. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk. We'll be right back.
The one who states his case first seems right until the other comes and examines him. My name is Abraham Hamilton III, and this is the Hamilton Minute. In the wake of the Talking Snake Media's absolutely false reporting concerning the Covington High School students, Whoopi Goldberg, co-host of The View, asked the panel why they thought the media continues to falsely report stories. In a moment of candor, Joy Behar responded, "It's because we're desperate to get Trump out of office." Behar included herself among the media hordes who are seething to see President Trump removed from office. Their emotional investment in overturning the will of over 60 million Americans drives them to lie, smear, and slander. At least, Joyless Behar admitted it.
Listen each weekday from 5 to 6 p.m. Central for the Hamilton Corner with Abraham Hamilton III, public policy analyst for the American Family Association.
Brian Fisher here with today's Life and Liberty Minute. Virginia Delegate Kathy Tran, with the governor's full support, is trying to legalize infanticide in the Old Dominion. Yes, you heard that right. Her bill would repeal every restriction on abortion that currently exists in state law. It would legalize all abortions through the entire 40 weeks of pregnancy. In a chilling exchange, Republican Todd Gilbert asked her about a woman on the verge of delivery. Gilbert said, where it's obvious a woman is about to give birth, that she has physical signs that she is about to give birth, would that be a point at which she could still request an abortion if she was so certified she's dilating? Delegate Tran, trapped with no exit, ruefully admitted, "Yes, my bill allows that." Somewhere, Satan is dancing with delight.
Catch Brian Fisher on Focal Point, weekday afternoons at 105 Central on American Family Radio.
Being in the ministry can be very demanding, as most pastors' wives can testify. Hi, I'm Jan Harper, and my husband Bert Harper and I would like to invite you pastors and wives to our AFA Fishbowl Retreat. Some might ask why it's called Fishbowl. The main reason is because it can feel like our lives are in clear view of so many people around us. Time away from that can help contribute to a healthy marriage and family, but we have to make the time.
This year, there are two AFA Fishbowl Retreats. The first one is coming up April 9th through 11th at Pine Grove Camp in Tyler, Texas. Pastor Jeff Shreve of First Baptist Church in Texarkana is host of From His Heart on American Family Radio, and he'll be our special speaker. Learn more at repairingthefoundations.net. Registration includes meals and lodging, but space is limited and will fill up quickly. Register by calling 800-326-4543, extension 300.
The AFA Pastors and Wives Fishbowl Retreat. We'll see you there.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Now that we've finished running the clock out on 2018, it's time to begin a new countdown. No, I'm not talking about the 2020 election TikTok, although Senator Elizabeth Warren and countless other Democratic presidential candidates earnestly want us to do so. Rather, experts say we face the prospect that in slightly less than 2 months, America will have lost, perhaps permanently, the ability to compete for, let alone dominate, the global marketplace for so-called 5G wireless technologies. If the United States doesn't engage immediately, these fifth-generation arbiters of the future of mobile communications, the Internet of Things, personal privacy, the state-of-the-art surveillance techniques, cyber warfare, and military superiority will be controlled instead by communist China. And such control will imperil this country's security and sovereignty and what remains of the free worlds. It's time to act while we still can. This is Frank Gaffney.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the Morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the Morning on American Family Radio.
The Maduro regime is launching an investigation into opposition leader Juan Guaido, trying to freeze his accounts and prevent him from leaving the country.
There is a citizen that has practically led and organized all this action that is causing Venezuela's detriment.
National Security Advisor John Bolton tweeted the United States denounces the threats against Guaido and that, quote, there will be serious consequences for those who attempt to subvert democracy and harm Guaido. Nicolas Maduro, the disputed president, is pressing Guaido, as the United States presses Maduro to yield power. This morning, the State Department announced Guaido now controls Venezuelan accounts at U.S.-insured banks, including the Federal Reserve Bank in New York.
What we're trying to do is to cut off the money to the regime that should not be in power and make sure that President Guaido has access to funds and has access to the assets of the country, and to make sure we protect these assets for the people of Venezuela.
It's also an attempt to firm up Guaido's legitimacy and convince Venezuelan officials to abandon Maduro, especially military leaders who say they stand behind him. For his part, Maduro announced he plans to strengthen the nation's armed militia in response to growing tension with the United States. About two dozen countries have joined the United States in recognizing Guaido as Venezuela's interim president. American adversaries China, Russia, and others back Maduro.
We expect the attempts by Cuba, Russia, and to some extent China, to prop up the Maduro regime's security or financing will lead to additional efforts to exploit the situation in exchange for access mostly to Venezuelan oil.
Russia has invested billions in Venezuela and remains critical of U.S. sanctions against Maduro and backing of Guaido. Less than a week after withdrawing some of its staff from Venezuela, the State Department raised its travel advisory today, warning Americans not to go there because of civil unrest, crime, and the arbitrary arrest of U.S. citizens.
I have to say that this reminds me a little bit of America during the Revolution, when we were fighting King George and we were just flailing about with so little resources. Our troops, as exemplified in Valley Forge, were freezing to death, starving to death, not being paid. It was a tragic, difficult time until France came in to help us. And if it hadn't been for the French and their financial support and their troops, Lafayette, the general, and so many others, we would never have prevailed in that war. It kind of reminds me of what the Trump administration and what John Bolton, who I know, I see John's hand behind this, and others, it's tipping the balance in Venezuela. My guest is Dr. Paul Coyer. Paul, I'm curious to know, you and I both know that Juan Guaido is in danger. I mean, the way it's being, the impression one could get was this is kind of like a done deal. He's declared himself interim president. He's appointing people. The president of the United States has thrown his support. He's got access to our accounts. There's no doubt that Maduro is in trouble, but it's not a done deal, is it?
That is correct. It is not. For one thing, Maduro, and it's not just Maduro. It has to be mentioned. Maduro is the name that everyone's familiar with. But there's a guy named Diosdado Cabello, who is actually much smarter than Maduro, because Maduro, as you noticed, his pedigree consists of being a bus driver before Hugo Chavez pulled him up and started making him senior government official. Not that I'm anything against bus drivers. However, he is not well prepared or educated and not very intelligent. Diosdado Cabello is extremely intelligent, extremely devious, and frankly, just the personification of human evil. He's one of the biggest narco traffickers and criminals and the biggest violent thugs in all of Latin America. He is one of the leaders of the Venezuelan Socialist Party. Previously, before the Democratic opposition took control of the National Assembly, he was the president of the National Assembly. And there's a number of others. Many of these people, their family relationships go back one and two generations. So this is a criminal clique that has been together, and their fathers have been together before them. So they're not going to give up power very easily. Excuse me. So you're absolutely right. This is not necessarily the end, even though Maduro is now for the first time in trouble. The key here is not necessarily going to be Russia and China, although yesterday a Russian airplane that can seat 400, that nobody knows who was in it or what was in it, arrived in Caracas Airport. And there are rumors, because we don't have hard and fast evidence, that possibly mercenaries from the Wagner Group, which is a well-known Russian mercenary company, have arrived to help bolster Maduro's security. Again, the role of the Cubans is far more important than anything the Russians or the Chinese could do now. But you're right that Maduro is not gone yet. And then the real key is going to be not just the Cubans, but also what Padrino means godfather, the current Minister of Defense, General Padrino, does. And he's been talking to some people and behind the scenes, meaning some good guys, without divulging who. And he is considering his options, and he does, from what I've heard, understand that it may well be in his best interest now to jump ship and to side with the side with Guaido. David Smolansky, Guaido's buddy that I hosted, is a friend of mine that I hosted at my institute on Monday, told me that about 2 weeks ago, 2 or 3 weeks ago, when Guaido was arrested just temporarily for 10 minutes by Maduro Security Services, they took him into their van, and he started talking to them. And they said, look, we just did this because we were ordered to. We're going to let you go. You are a legitimate president. So the fissures within the military and security community, the Venezuelan aspect of it, are deep. So that's what we need to focus on right now. And that's one of the things the Trump administration is focusing on, is trying to exacerbate those and convince as much of the military as possible to side with Guaido.
My understanding is that one top colonel has defected to Guaido, but there are like nine generals who are loyal to Maduro. And this is really interesting to me. Now, but you, in our conversations before, you've taught me a lot about this, Paul, but you said earlier in our conversation that, of course, Cubans have been imported since the 50s, and there are 40,000 now who are kind of surrounding Maduro, and that military
has... the bad Cubans, the bad guys, they've only been coming in since Hugo Chavez was president, since 1999.
Okay. And they're filling the intelligence services and all of that. And you also had described in our prior conversations that the military has very special privileges, highly paid. They're not starving like the rest of the people. So it's hard for them to defend.
Enlisted men are indeed in trouble economically. Okay. So that's why you have a big big change in perception between the enlisted men and the officers, and even the junior and mid-level officers. Many times they don't have the same salary and the same privileges as the senior officers do, which creates a big problem within any military. Anyone will tell you, you've got to have, you can't have that big of divergence in views, and there is that right now. So it's really only the guys at the top or near the top of the Israel military that are making out in this scheme to control the graft and to control Venezuela's, food and everything else that they put them in charge of. So the lower-level guys, they're siding with Guaido.
The other thing that really surprised me, well, no, it didn't surprise me, it's just I didn't know it. There are other non-state actors, other people from other countries also involved, like the Colombian FARC, that terrorist organization, and Hezbollah, also part of the military, which is this frightening, isn't it? I mean, really
and
is frightening on its face.
The Iranian Quds Force has been in western Venezuela on the Colombian border for quite some time.
So this is not a done deal, and Juan Guaido is really taking his life in his hands by stepping out like this. He does have good support, reason to be hopeful, but he is still, I would say, very much in danger, as are all of those people who decide to publicly endorse him. Let's go back again. You were explaining before the break, Paul, about Juan Guaido's political philosophy, and you said his party is a socialist party, but you were distinguishing, and so I want you to start there again, please, and help us to understand why that might not be such a bad thing in this case.
His party is more like a social democrat party that we would have among the mainstream in Europe today. Again, is that where people like you, Sandy, or myself would be? No. However, these are people that they believe in a larger state role. They believe in a more expansive social welfare system than the average Republican voter would be comfortable with. However, they are not by any means, strictly speaking, socialist in the sense that they believe in government taking over and running the means of production, which is what the Maduro regime has done. For instance, a lot of people on the left today in the United States, as you know, they point to Denmark and Scandinavia and say, this is an example of why socialism is so great. Look at how prosperous these societies are. Ignoring the fact, number one, that there are only a very few million people in each of these countries, they have very small populations. In the case of Norway, they have massive North Sea oil reserves that are subsidizing their ability to have a vast social welfare system. But most importantly, these people are ignoring the fact that in many ways the economies of these Scandinavian countries are more free market-based than is the American one. And that may surprise some people, but when you look at the amount of regulations and other things, it's actually the ease of doing business and economic freedom indexes show that many times these Scandinavian countries rank higher than the United States does. And that's because they are not, strictly speaking, socialist. The free market really holds sway there. They just have a government that uses a lot of their money to do a social welfare system. So that's why they're called socialists, by people that really don't quite understand what socialism actually means. So that's somewhat similar to what the Voluntad Popular is. They're more along the lines of the European Social Democrat Party.
Okay, because we brought this up in the earlier discussion, I'm just curious. We talked about the strength of the church, whether it's the Catholic Church or the Evangelical Church in Venezuela, does Juan Guaido have an affiliation with any of those groups, or is he a-religious, or do we just not know?
I have no idea, to be honest. I really don't know. I don't know, nor do I know David Smolansky, his friend that's here in Washington now. I don't know his faith views at all. We haven't discussed it. We've discussed politics. We've discussed geopolitics. We have not discussed religion and faith, so I'm not really sure. But I wanted to say something else I think you'll find interesting before I forget. You know, the charges that the left has made, and a lot of the left here in the United States has been defending, sadly, Maduro, and attacking Trump. One example is the brand-new freshman congresswoman from Minnesota, Ilhan Omar, who has said that Trump is instituting a, quote, far-right American coup against a democratically elected president, which is absurd on its face, and shows her complete ignorance of the situation in Venezuela. One of the things I think that stands in Trump's favor, the fact that Juan Guaido is actually a social democrat and his party is a member of the Socialist International, it really shows that Trump is not instituting anyone who is quote-unquote far-right, and he's quite pragmatic. He just wants to reinstitute democracy, and he's supporting anyone right, left, or center who will do that. And that obviously, again, shows that he's doing the right thing, number one. Number two, the charge is laid that America's just in this because we want Venezuela's oil. We've always had Venezuela's oil in the sense that our refineries in the Gulf Coast have been the ones that have the capacity to take that heavy oil and refine it. And we have always paid market prices for Venezuela's oil, whereas right now, Russia, China, Cuba have been getting that oil for free. And so they're the ones that are actually behaving in a quote-unquote imperialist manner. We have always treated Venezuela fairly in that sense. Not always. You can go back 120 years. You'll see some of the American or more oil majors that were heavy-handed. But we're talking in recent history. We've always paid market prices. So both of those charges from the left are completely wrong once you look at the facts.
Well, it's probably true that the economic pressures, the sanctions now on their oil, and the shutting Maduro away from off from the money that the funds that are here in the United States and putting them in the hands of Guaido, those financial pressures will probably bring along some of those military well-paid people, wouldn't you think?
Likely, yes, yes. And I wanted to say also that in terms of the protest, because in one of the lead-ups to you and I talking, I heard the individual who's giving the news summary correctly say that there are more protests planned for this Saturday. The Maduro regime has actually successfully done a pretty good job of suppressing much of the turnout, because he's going to many of the slums where people used to be chavistas because they believed Hugo Chavez is us versus them, I'm with the poor, BS, frankly, and rhetoric. Excuse me. And they have been actually just killing people, just summary executions. If you're going out in the street, especially from the slums and from the poor areas, security services recognize your face, and then even execute innocent people just to strike fear into anybody that might want to go out and protest. So at night they're coming in to these barrios and they're just killing people in their homes in front of their families.
Oh,
and that's successfully suppressing the turnout.
Yes, well, it would, wouldn't it? And so with that in mind, that's the reason we keep talking about this. We would ask people to pray. Remember the people of Venezuela and be proud of our government for interceding in the right way to release from this bondage. Paul Coyer, thank you so much for joining me this morning. Thank you all for listening. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.